This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Hello everyone.
大家好.
Selamat datang.
Konnichiwa.
Hola.
안녕하세요.
Assalamualaikum.
And kia ora.
Kia ora everyone, welcome back to Connecting Cultures Features, a show by, for and about the multicultural people of Dunedin in New Zealand. Today we have Sasi Thorne, the manager of the English Language Partners here in Otipoti Dunedin with us. Kia ora, Sasi Thorne.
Kia ora. Sawadika.
Sawadika. Thank you so much for being here. One of the things that I really remember about you was you brought really yummy pad thai at one of the cultural lunches. I think you bought it at Kindy, and ever since then, I've been going there every week.
Oh, nice.
But do you want to introduce yourself to our listeners before we start?
Sure. So my name is Sasi Thorne, and I was trained as an ESOL teacher. Yeah, I got my teaching degree from the UK. Came to New Zealand in 1994, to start a family, I started working at the University of Otago Language Centre, and with the College of Education for a while, and then moved to Rangiora near Christchurch, and then we moved overseas for a short while, and then came back to a job in Hamilton, and I was there for 10 years before coming back down here because Dunedin. Is where I started.
Do you feel quite connected to Otipoti?
Yes, it's always been my second home.
Because you were here working at the language centre at Otago. Mm-hmm. What year was that?
Oh, 1994. Yeah, 1994 up until about 1999. Yeah, I was there.
Wow.
A long time.
I asked because I love the Language Centre because I went to the foundation year,
right?
Which is over there as well.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. It's really cool that now you're here and you have the cool job, like the coolest job ever, of being a manager of the English Language Partners. And you guys are also our neighbors here in the community house. Mm. But you said that you trained as a teacher from the UK.
Mm-hmm.
So do you do your studies there?
Yes. I did my master's degree at Birmingham University in the UK.
Have you always known you were going to be a teacher?
I guess so. I started off as a teacher in a secondary school, teaching English. Yes, and then I moved to teach in a refugee camp. Yeah, I was there for a while, and then I decided to, get an extra qualification to enable me to work overseas. And that's why I went to the UK.
So tell me how it all started. Where were you born and what was like growing up?
All right. I was born in Chiang Mai in Thailand. Chiang Mai is a city in the north of Thailand. I think it's the biggest city in the north of Thailand. Yeah. And I grew up there and went to, did my first degree there in English literature and linguistics. Like I said, started working in a secondary school teaching English there, and then got a job in a refugee camp.
So you sort of already knew you wanted to study English.
Yes.
What was it like, at home? Do you learn English as your second language or first language?
Yeah, no, I went to a Catholic school, run by European nuns. So English is it's not a medium of instruction as such, but English is a you know, is a big part of the school.
Ah.
And we've got all of the teachers, you know, that I had were native speakers of English. So, yeah.
Is it quite common for Thailand to have those Catholic schools?
There are quite a few sort of religious schools, like Catholic schools. There are some run by American missionaries. You know, my secondary school, it's a Presbyterian sort of school run by American missionaries.
So you've always, you know, been around English language.
Yes, I suppose. Yeah.
What about your family?
I guess it really depends. My family, my mum's a nurse, and my dad, you know, worked as in a landscape sort of business, gardening, landscaping business. So nobody was really into, you know,
what about your siblings?
English. My brother is okay, but he's not interested.
No. Oh. No. Did you enjoy reading English books?
Yes.
Oh, what
yes.
kind of books did you read?
I read lots of books. Yeah. I spent most of my school years in a library.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. So I read lots of books, and I love English books. Yeah. I got a talking English book as a birthday present when I was 7 or 8.
Wow.
And I was hooked since then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's how it all started, the talking English book.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
That's really cool to know how, you know, you were the only one in the family that really got interested in learning English to the point where it's what you studied during university.
Yes.
At university, what course did you choose?
I did English literature and some papers in linguistics.
Is that something common for people in your culture?
I guess so, yeah, I guess so. It's in Thailand, to be a teacher, well, in those days anyway, to be a teacher, you don't really have to have a teaching degree. You know, you can be, I suppose, an expert in your subject, and you'll be able to teach. When I finished my first degree in English, I was employed as a teacher straight away. I didn't know anything about teaching, just sort of had to learn, you know, through experience.
So who are your students then?
I started in a sort of a junior class. There would be about 10, 11 year olds. And then I moved to secondary level, so a bit older, you know, 13, 14. Yeah.
What was your favorite age to teach?
It's a boys' school.
Oh.
So I guess the older, the better.
They understand more. Yeah.
And
less naughty.
The classes are very big too. You know, they're like 40. Yeah, about 40 in one class. So 10, 11 year olds, they're really hard to control.
Yeah.
I remember the first week I was teaching. My students got so noisy that a maths teacher from, you know, next door classroom came and told us off, told us all off.
Did they have too much fun in your class? That's so exciting. I can see your face glowing up to talk about them.
No, it was a good experience. Yeah.
Yeah. So I can see that, you know, you sort of already knew from a very young age that you wanted to be a teacher. Did you have other options, or did you have like a plan B?
Not really, no.
Wow. Yeah. That is so cool. Because you know, when I talk to other people, they're like, oh, I thought I wanted to be this, and then this happened, and this happened. But,
I mean, that was my only goal in life, pretty much.
Wow. Do you have supportive parents?
My mother wanted me to be a nurse, of course, but I can't stand the sight of blood and stuff. So
for you. Yeah. Oh wow. Yeah. I'm interested to learn more about your culture. Mm-hmm. Because I'm from Malaysia, the northern side of Malaysia, which is Perlis, which is quite connected to Songkla, Hat Yai. So sometimes from Malaysia, we would go to Thailand for lunch because it's that close. But, you know, I've never been to the north side of Thailand because Thailand's huge. So I've never been to Chiang Mai. But can you tell us more about Thailand, and also what it was like growing up for you over there?
Mm-hmm. Well, the north is, Thailand has got four distinct sort of regions. You know, we've got the north, the northeast, then central Thailand, and then the south. And each region has its own kind of, traditions and, its own dialect as well, you know. So, for example, I grew up speaking a northern dialect, and that's quite different, you know, from the central Thai or from the sort of the Thai language that general people know and learn, you know. I don't speak Thai very well. I can, you know, my northern dialect, I can speak fluently and everything like that. I don't speak Thai very well. I have to think of, you know, words before I can say them.
Yeah.
Mm. And the south is different again. You know, the south, like you said, the south has got some influence from Malaysia, I suppose. Yeah, quite a lot of Muslim population. Mm. Mm. And the northeast has got influence from, you know, from Laos, from, that northern part of their region. And my ancestors came from Burma, actually, Myanmar now. Mm. So we're a mixture of, Burmese and Northern Thai, you know.
Which side of the family are from Burma?
My mother's side. In the olden days, you know, Thailand, you know, well, that part anyway. In the olden days, the north was independent. Then we always had battles with, Myanmar, and every time one side lost the battle, the people would be migrating, moving. I think that when Myanmar lost a battle, that's when my family, my mother's side, my ancestors got sort of rounded up and moved to Thailand. They were craftspeople, so carpenters and silversmiths.
Wow.
My ancestors were carpenters. I can't remember the name for it, but they did the seat that kings used to sit on
throne.
An elephant.
On
an elephant especially. So they were people who made those. And I guess there was a need, you know, in the north at the time, and that's why they got rounded up to go to
they were looking for the skills.
Thailand, that's right. Yeah.
Wow.
Those are my ancestors.
That sounds like a proud, you know, family history as well, having all those skills.
There's a village of them in Chiang Mai. You know, if you go to visit Chiang Mai, you can still see them. A village of silversmiths and craftspeople there, but they were originally from Myanmar.
I'm glad that it's passed down and there's still a community that appreciates the art and just keeps creating it. Are you creative yourself?
No, not really, no.
It's in the blood. Have you tried?
Yeah. Well, my daughter's an artist,
I guess
it got passed down.
Skipped a generation.
Skipped a generation.
That's wow. Yeah. That is so cool. It's really good for me to understand the history of Thailand and how different regions are as well. Because you've lived in other countries, you have studied in the UK, you've came to New Zealand, different parts of New Zealand as well. I'm sure you've realized how different your culture is as compared to other countries. What is special about Thai culture?
What people know about Thailand would be food, you know, Thai food, and Thailand's it's well visited by tourists, by foreigners. So people kind of sort of know Thailand as a country with some particular traditions, unique culture. I grew up, what formed Thailand as a culture would be their religion, Buddhism. Yeah. So I grew up with, Buddhism, with some Buddhist teaching and even though I don't go to the temple or anything now, I mean it's still a part of me, and I think that's a sort of I think it's a part of most Thais as well.
Even if you don't do the religion, the values
that's right,
in the household that
that's right,
makes
yeah,
it normal.
That's right. Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit about Buddhism and what's distinguishable about them?
I guess Buddhism is what makes Thai people kind of friendly and gentle, I guess, if you can describe them like that. We don't kill animals, even little animals like ants or mosquitoes and flies and things like that. So we kind of learn to help other people, it's fundamental in every religion, I guess, but it's what was drilled into us, from a very young age. Yeah, but I grew up with both Buddhism and, like I said, in a Catholic school, so I studied the Bible as well.
Your parents, were they quite religious as well?
No, not really. But we do what Buddhists do. We go to the temple. On a Buddhist day, and you kind of make merit, giving is a big part of Buddhism, giving, helping other, helping neighbors and other people.
And then at school you practice Catholicism. It sounds like you had a very open-minded childhood.
Buddhism is not a religion of faith, which means that there is no kind of restriction on, as to what you can study and what you can't study, what you can do and what you can't do. I studied the Bible and that was, interesting. And yeah, when I grew up and I learned about some other sects in, you know, in Buddhism. And yeah, and then it was, yeah, it's very interesting to me.
Well, it's so good to know that, you know, you grew up around diversity. That's something that you're quite used to.
Yeah, probably not so much diversity in race, but more sort of diversity in religions and
the way people think.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So tell me about your first move. Mm-hmm. So you grew up in Thailand. Mm-hmm. Where was the first place you went overseas?
The
UK. Mm-hmm. What was it like then? How old were you?
I was in my 20s when I was when I went to the UK. It was a very eye-opening experience, because all the foreigners I met in Thailand, they were all very kind and, all the Western people who travel, they have a reason to travel. But in their own country, they're a little bit different. So I met some nice people and some not so nice people. And
that's just life.
That's just life. But one thing racism in my time there was a lot more visible, a lot more kind of blatant,
Because you were in your 20s. Mm-hmm. What was it like adjusting to a new culture?
I wasn't really exposed to, I was exposed to the culture, but not, how shall I put it? But I didn't really sort of live in the culture. I wasn't really immersed in that culture. I mean, I was at the university, so a lot of the friends I had were from other countries.
International friends.
International students. A few, English friends, but not too many. What else can I say about the experience? I lived in a Methodist church house, which was a house for international students. So so apart from friends at the university, I also had friends in the, house, in my accommodation. So it was a lovely experience.
And what year was this?
1990.
What was UK like then?
It was, I was there during the Gulf War, if you remember the Gulf War.
Wow.
So there was a lot of hostility against foreigners in general, I don't know why, but there was a lot of hostility at the time, during the Gulf War. But most people, most of the UK people that I met, they were kind, But if you go to the market, for example, it's a different story.
It's interesting that. Because you were there at the time, so this was just the timing. And how long were you there for your studies?
We were there a couple of years. Not quite 2 years. No.
And then you went back to Thailand to teach.
Went back to the to one of the refugee camps. And then went over to Cambodia.
Tell me about Cambodia.
It was a time when the UN was there keeping peace, and it was the time when the UN was there to run the first election. So I was there training interpreters to help with Yeah, to help with some, what you call, you know, people who run the election. Yes, because there were a lot of UN peacekeepers there, you know, to help with the election.
Mm. That's a very important job.
Yeah.
you were training the people who were going to, you know, lead the elections. Yeah.
Yeah.
So because your languages are Thai and English.
Yeah. And by then I spoke Khmer as well.
Was that something that you were used to?
I learned it in the camp. Yeah, when I was in the when I was in the refugee camp in the border of Thailand, that's where I learned learned the Cambodian language.
Because you needed to do that in order to teach them.
I didn't know that I would need it, but I learned it because not many people in the camp spoke English, so I had to, you know, learn the language to communicate with them.
What was it like learning that language?
It wasn't difficult because it was quite similar to the Thai language. The written language is very similar to, you know, the Thai written language. The script is different, but the learning to speak definitely is a lot easier than learning to write. So I learned to speak it in quite a short time.
Wow. Yeah. And I'm glad that you were there to support them in that process as well. What was it like being in a refugee camp at that time?
In a refugee camp itself, it was peaceful, but I spent some time in what they called a displaced persons camp, and that was quite volatile because there, you know, people were able to move across the border at any time, so sometimes it was quite dangerous. Sometimes because there were still, fighting along the border. So sometimes you get, you could hear shellings and fighting and.
What do you remember most about that time?
I remember one time we had to evacuate the camp, and I can't remember why, but I was I couldn't catch the I was with the IRC International Rescue Committee, but I couldn't catch the IRC vehicle, so I had to go in with an International Red Cross vehicle. So I went into the back of their truck, and there were lots of things in the truck, you know. So I said, "Oh, that's okay. I can just squeeze in," you know. Went in there, and when I looked around, when the vehicle moved, I looked around. I saw in a crate a very, very big snake.
Oh no!
That just gave me a fright. The biggest fright of my life.
It was not meant to be there, was it?
No, it was meant to be there.
Oh, so it was going to travel.
It was supposed to be there because it's a Red Cross, you know, runs the hospital in the camp. So they've got all, you know, I think snakes, you know, snakes have serum for snake bites.
Yeah.
And that's probably what that snake is there for.
Wow.
So, it was the biggest fright of my life. So I had to sort of sit, you know, next to this snake crate all the way through.
How long was the ride?
Oh, about half an hour.
Yeah, but it's a very long half an hour.
Yeah.
But that's a very important snake, you know.
It has
the serum to take care of people.
And I was lying there peacefully, quietly, you know. Aww. But it was just me not being happy about it.
Yeah. But look at you, now you can tell people about this story. Oh, wow. What a special moment to share, because, being in a refugee camp, I'm sure there are lots of stories of, the reason why people have refugee camps, it's from a displaced or unsettled time. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, you learn their language, Khmer mm-hmm. language, mm-hmm. and I think it's pretty special that, you know, as you're teaching English to other people, you're also gaining a new knowledge as well.
Yes, definitely. And
so from that experience, mm-hmm. how did you somehow end up in New Zealand?
I forgot to talk about my husband then.
A very important person to the story.
So I met my husband when I started teaching in a refugee camp. It wasn't really a refugee camp as such. It was what they called a processing center. And these were refugees who had already been accepted to go to the third countries by the UNHCR. So our job there was to teach them, to prepare them to go to, at the time it was the biggest group of refugees were going to the USA. Mm. So I was there teaching, and he was also there teaching.
Ah.
Yeah, but he was, my husband was at the University of Otago, and he went there as an exchange student, an archaeology student, and then he decided to stay on, So then he got a job in the camp, so the same camp that I am.
Where was he from?
He's a Kiwi.
Oh, he's a Kiwi. Okay, yeah, so he's a Kiwi, and he studied archaeology at the University of Otago.
Anthropology. Archaeology, yes.
Oh, cool. Yeah. And then you met at the camp.
Yes, that's right.
What was his role at the camp?
I was teaching English to people who had, who were pre-literate or had no literacy background. But he was in the other part, he was giving them cultural orientation, teaching them about the culture, the Western culture, because they would be going to America. So mostly American culture. So he was there doing that. And I was,
So you were teaching the language, he was teaching the culture.
That's right. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. What a great team. And that's how you got to know him.
Yes. So we met there
That's beautiful. Another beautiful thing that happened at that camp. Mm. And then is that when you followed him to New Zealand?
No, we went to the UK together. Because he was born in the UK, my husband. He still got family in the UK. So when we first got there, we stayed with his aunt for a short while before we moved out. So that was helpful.
Yeah. So you got to, be with the family.
Yeah, for a short while, yes.
And so what made you all move back to New Zealand at that time?
I guess we were always planning to be here. So we came thinking that we came sort of basically just to see how, to see what we could do. And then I got a job teaching, at the university. And then he did a course to, you know, I did a course in horticulture, you know, because that was what he was always interested in. Ah. And, and then we had, we had our daughter the following year.
Yeah. What was your impression of New Zealand? Because you've been to the UK, I'm sure it's very different.
Yeah, New Zealand's a lot quieter and a lot more peaceful. It's quite different, I guess. You know, but that would be, that was my first impression, you know, of it being very quiet and very peaceful. And we came here in November, and that's when the university students had all left town.
Oh, so super quiet.
Super quiet, oh. You know. But when they came back in February, it got a lot noisier.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So just thinking about, because Dunedin was your first base in New Zealand. So, it is your second home. Mm. Did you meet any Thai people or any people from your culture down here at
the
time?
There were quite a few at the time, yes. There were quite a few at a time.
Was there a community or people who you know?
I started having a job, so I didn't really have time to go and meet anyone. So the first Thai person that I met was through... there were quite a few Thai students at the time. So the first Thai person that I met here was through a Thai student, you know, through a homestay. A Thai student who had a homestay, who knew another, a family with a Thai, a Thai lady. So, so that's how I got to know. When once you get introduced to a few more.
Yeah.
Yeah. But like I said, because I work full time, I don't usually have time to go and, socialize with them much.
But at least you know they're there.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. But we know each other and, we say hello when we meet.
So what was Dunedin like then? Because, now we have lots of Thai restaurants, Thai massages. What was Dunedin like back then?
Oh, it wasn't like this. Yeah, definitely wasn't like this. There were a couple of Thai restaurants. One was down the peninsula way.
Oh, quite
far away. And there was one in town. Not many other kind of, other ethnic restaurants either.
Was food important to you? Having cultural foods?
Yeah, well, because we eat Thai food at home, and I cook Thai food at home. So it doesn't really doesn't really bother us really if there is no Thai restaurant. But but I think in 19 what year would it be? When 1998, there was an influx of Korean and Japanese migrants coming into New Zealand, and there are a lot more Japanese and Korean restaurants then. But now, of course, you get all kinds of ethnic restaurants.
It's interesting to be able to witness that change in Dunedin.
But Dunedin has always had a lot of international students. So I guess the visibility of international people has always been here.
And you moved to Hamilton. What was it like living there as compared to Dunedin?
Hamilton's very different. Hamilton, the first thing that I noticed about Hamilton was how diverse it was, you know, compared to Dunedin. Well, the Dunedin that I knew anyway, you know, Hamilton has got all kinds of ethnicities and, very, very diverse, a lot more people, a lot more crowded. Because I'm a bit biased, so I would say Hamilton is not as beautiful as you know, architecturally, you know, not as beautiful as Dunedin. Dunedin has got lots of, you know, lovely old buildings, you know, beautiful buildings.
Mm. Yeah, and because you are artistic and creative, you have a good eye for all of that. Oh, and so what was your favorite memory about living in Hamilton before you came back here?
Hamilton's got a lovely garden. It's got a lovely, beautiful sort of international gardens. And that's my favorite place to go and visit.
I went there a couple of years ago and I couldn't finish all of that because there was just so much.
Yes.
But it's gorgeous, eh?
Beautiful. Yeah. And every time, different time of the year, it's also different.
Yeah.
So, you know, every time you go, you see something different.
Yeah. Is that something that you spend time at?
Yes. Yeah.
So what did you do in Hamilton?
Apart from working, I did dragon boating as well up in Hamilton.
Yeah. What's that?
Dragon boating. paddling in a boat as a team. So we're in a 20-person team.
Wow.
Yeah, so so you sit alongside you sit alongside each other and then I paddle on the left and someone paddle on the right. Yeah.
And then there's 20 of you.
20.
In one boat.
Yeah.
Wow, so that's considered like a sport that you play?
Yeah, it's a sport. Yeah. The first time I was I did a bit of dragon boating when I was living in Laos for a couple of years. But the team there is a lot bigger. It's a longer boat, so a 40-person team.
Wow.
Mm. But the boats here in New Zealand are a little bit shorter. So, only a 20-person team. But the team that I was with was a team of breast cancer survivors. Yeah, so there were maybe half of the boat were breast cancer survivors, and the rest are just us supporting.
So is it also, you know, for charity as well? Like you collect donations?
I think because dragon boating has been recommended as a sport for breast cancer survivors, because of the way you exercise your arms, your shoulders, your lymph nodes,
Wow, I learned something new today. That's very interesting.
Mm.
I didn't realize that we had dragon boating in New Zealand.
It's quite popular in the north. I suppose in the south because of the weather. I've seen an event here once, you know, a long time ago that, you know, in the time then that I wasn't even, you know, wasn't involved in dragon boating, but there was an event here once and they did it out in the harbour.
Wow.
Yeah, when the, when the weather was calm. But I guess it's not very easy to do it often. Whereas up in the north, you know, we practice in a lake. Hamilton's got a lake, you see. So we practice in a lake. In New Plymouth, they practice in a river. Yeah, so Hamilton's got both a river and a lake, but we mostly practice in a lake. So some people practice in Wellington. I think they practice out in the harbour as well. I'm not 100%. In Auckland, they also practice in a bay or a harbour.
It's so interesting. It's a North Island thing just because of the weather here.
There's a team in Christchurch, I think. Yeah, there's a team in Christchurch. There was an event in, where was it, Ashburton once, I think. Yeah, I can't remember.
Wow. So coming back out of the flashback, uh-huh. Now you're here in Dunedin as the manager of the English Language Partners here in Dunedin. Quite recent as well, a few months, right? How are you liking your job?
How shall I put it? The job itself, it's not difficult, you know, because I've managed the same programs, before in Hamilton. Different people, of course, you know. So I guess I could say that I'm really enjoying being in the job that I can do. I can do a lot, you know, for. And there are things that I can start, from my experience that I bring with me to the job. You know, I can start some new things, and because I've learned, from my old job what works and what doesn't. So it's enjoyable.
So how big is the English Language Partners community? Like, how many students do you have down here in Dunedin, and who are they?
In Dunedin, I think there are around 160 students. I look after both in Dunedin and Invercargill, and I think there are about half that in Invercargill. Yeah, and most of the students are migrant and from migrant and refugee backgrounds.
Are there certain countries that is more dominant than others?
Dunedin is a settlement centre for Syrian and Afghan former refugees. So we've got quite a big number of Syrian and Afghan students. Down in Invercargill, Invercargill is a settlement centre for Congolese and Colombian refugees. So they're different again. But migrants, we've got migrants, I guess, from all kinds of nationalities, really.
It's really cool that you get to see the different kinds of people you teach, comparing Dunedin to Invercargill, because, you take care of the Southland branch, right? How does the classes work?
We've got classes for we've got classes from people with no literacy background. So we've got what we call an ESOL, so English for speakers of other languages, ESOL literacy classes, and then we've got ESOL intensive classes, you know, once they gain some confidence, once they know, you know, they learn some reading and writing, some basic oral language, they move on to an ESOL intensive program where they kind of, you know, learn more. And then after that, they progress to a qualification program. It's a NZCEL program. A New Zealand Certificate in English Language, which is a national qualification. And when they finish with us, they can go on to study more English at the Otago Polytech in order to move on to other mainstream subjects. So we are kind of like a foundation, so to speak, you know?
Mm. Yeah. Mm. And there's always these steps that, yes, you know, they can,
yes,
take.
That's right. Yeah.
What do you love most about your job?
I guess it's very rewarding to see, students being successful, you know, moving on, progressing, you know, to the next level, you know, and some may not end up sort of, you know, studying further, but they get jobs, you know, or they become very confident, operating in English in the community.
Mm. Oh.
So it's good to see that. Yeah. Lovely to see that.
Because when they say goodbye to English language partners, it means they're graduating and they, they move on.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Wow. Because that's what we want to see. You know, we want to see people living in New Zealand happily, contributing to, you know, the society in some ways. You know, some of our learners who have reached quite a high level, they come back to become a volunteer with us. You know, they we have ELP. We have quite a large number of volunteers doing home tutoring. You know, that's a very important part of the organization.
It's beautiful that they want to give back.
Yes,
well,
yes, no, it's lovely, and they would be, you know, the most ideal, people to do the job because they know what it's like.
Exactly.
Mm.
What are you most excited for in the future? Yeah, it's really interesting that, you know, we're talking about this in December and there's a whole new year coming really soon. But is there anything you're excited for?
Well, I'm hoping that we could, you know, move to a bigger space upstairs, you know, on the sixth floor here in the community house. And that would be exciting. Yeah, and I'm also hoping to expand, you know, our little school, you know, a bit further, you know, hoping to have more students, hoping to do more for, you know, our students here.
And so with English language partners, how does one register or if they want to start learning English?
They can come and meet us at our office on level 2, Dunedin Community House. And come and talk to us and we can sort of, you know, interview them and then maybe give them a short test, you know, just to see where we can place them in our programs. You know, we've got, like I said, different programs that, that they can choose from or that would best, you know, that would suit their needs. Mm.
So there's, it's as easy as just coming and have a chat and see you.
Yes, that's right.
Where people can place you.
That's right. And we are very friendly. So.
Yes, I can say that because I've met everyone in the team. Well, thank you so much, Sasitone, for being here today to share about your journey.
Yeah.
I love everything that we learned from you today. Didn't realize, you know, you were in dragon boating and also how you met your husband. That's such a beautiful story.
Thank you.
But we love being your neighbor and all the best for ELP in the new year.
Thank you very much and all the best to you too.
Thanks for listening to Connecting Cultures Features on RFM.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.